The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, September 29, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, last week it seemed, at least in front of the Senate, like it was open season on the Wells Fargo Bank.
So you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive.
$19.3 million.
Now that's good money.
It's not only too big to fail, but it's too big to manage and it's too big to regulate.
You have done something that has never happened in the last 10 years and united this committee on a major topic.
It's gutless leadership.
Wells Fargo's CEO John Stumpf is back in Washington, D.C. today for a hearing before the House Financial Services Committee. As the broader realization of what his institution has done dawns on American consumers at large. This bank, which now serves 1 in 3 households and employs approximately 1 in 600 working Americans, allegedly pressured some of those employees to open multiple sham accounts for customers, creating as many as 2 million fee-paying rip-off accounts that just sat there delivering money into the coffers of Wells Fargo Bank. It's been fined $185 million for the alleged fraud. Stumpf himself has been fined approximately $41 million in stock awards. And among the 5,300 employees who've been fired, many of whom are now suing in class action cases. Yesterday, California's treasurer John Chung announced that the state was to suspend all business relationships with the bank for at least a year, citing Wells Fargo's, quote, venal abuse of its customers. We spoke with the California treasurer, who wanted listeners to understand that this is a very special and egregious form of bank criminality. Chung says that his action is an attempt to keep this kind of aggressive exploitation from becoming the norm in an increasingly electronic financial world.
The consumers who place their faith and trust in Wells Fargo to safeguard their monies, they expected strong financial advice as individuals were reaching out to them, talking about different opportunities. And the fact that at the very top of Wells Fargo, the way they handled their culture, Wells Fargo has had a storied history in California, but you saw what they did to their employees. They left them hanging. And the fact that you had leadership that didn't own up to its responsibilities. And as the state of California, we do a lot of business with Wells Fargo. We expect them to perform at the highest level, to bring forward their best integrity, to make sure that our reputation isn't at stake, that we know that we're going to get a sound product, and that we have a strong working relationship. And the fact that they left their consumers out hanging out to dry didn't portend well for all of us.
What do you say to individuals who would look at this and go, hey, fraud is fraud, and why are we making such a big deal about Wells Fargo? You know, it's the same whether you're just skimming money off some giant, you know, pool of capital versus skimming money out of the pockets of consumers. Why do these crimes seem particularly TV ready, shall we say?
Fraud is fraud, so I am not defending it in any sense, but people have to take on what has occurred to real people. The person who's trying to make their lives work, especially middle and low income individuals where they're undergoing tremendous economic struggle, trying to pay for their rent or their electricity bill or for a tank of gas, somebody needs to protect those $10, that $15, that the $50 in fees. And it shouldn't be done by people who are making a lot of money at their expense. So it needs to stop. I think people are incredibly infuriated and insulted by what had happened during the last global financial crisis. They wanted to see their partners, especially in the financial industry, where too many people are struggling, stand up for them. And that culture has unfortunately not turned around.
Finally, the price of that trust. The bank's been fined $185 million. John Stump apparently is docked $41 million in stock awards. 5,300 employees have been fired. You know, that's upwards of $230 million that Wells Fargo has had to pay. How much do you think your suspension costs Wells Fargo approximately?
I don't have a hard amount because we don't know how much business they would have garnered in the future. But this is a huge and powerful statement to Wells Fargo and about Wells Fargo. And I think they're taking it seriously that we are the largest municipal issuer in this country. We are oftentimes the first mover. And so that if they want to reestablish to others, in part because people will build their lines of businesses based on doing business with the state of California, because they say the big mover in the market is California, that they're going to have to improve their practices. They're going to have to recognize the harms that they committed upon individuals, and that they are going to think about what they do to make sure that Wells Fargo reestablishes the reputation that they had in the past. This is California scale. This is big.
California State Treasurer John Chung joined us from Sacramento, California. Secretary, thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You are now on the inside of what I like to call Circle of Trust.
You want me to trust you? Don't use big words you don't understand.
News consumers have gone into their corners.
It's time for Who Do You Trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
What we have to begin to do is look to ourselves.
I've given up lying and trusting.
Trust in me.
As you can hear, trust is at the center of the Wells Fargo case, which makes our week-long series on trust that much more relevant to the daily headlines. How much is trust at the center of banking? Well, that's the question prize-winning author Liaquat Ahmed enthusiastically took on for us. He wrote the modern classic, The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World, which examined the lead-up to the 1929 stock market crash through the lives of the world's most powerful central bankers and the lessons for our time. Our series is called Got Trust? Exploring Faith and Suspicion in the 21st Century. And Liaquat Ahmed told us that if bankers lose trust, then they've got nothing. He took us back to a time when an even more powerful banker was laid low on Capitol Hill by losing sight of real people as the financial system grew ever larger.
J.P. Morgan, I think, was famously in front of a congressional committee, and someone asked him, how do you decide who to lend money to? And he said, character. And that meant that it was an insider's game, and they lent to people they knew. And it worked reasonably well when the financial system was run by small-town bankers who were lending to people in their community. I think as the financial system has become bigger and more impersonal, and the role of small-town banks has become much less, banks have had to rely much more on impersonal and quantitative measures, so all of this credit scoring. And that has sort of introduced a sense that you've got this giant machine that is outside the community's control.
Was the crash in 2008 essentially a failure of trust, that risks that were trusted turned out to be wrong, or did they just stop evaluating it in any real sense?
Mark Twain once described it as follows. A banker is a man who lends you his umbrella when it's sunny outside and wants it back when it starts raining. So in the good times, banks are liberal with credit. And in the bad times, because for very good reasons, they worry that they're not going to get their money back, they tighten up.
In the Great Depression of the 1930s, as you write, in your book, among the corrections that were made, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which was supposed to say to American consumers who put their money in banks before and had it just vanish, that up to $125,000, you're fine. You don't have to think about it. We've lived with that for so long now. Is it trust, or is it an ironclad guarantee that motivates Americans' willingness to give their money to the financial sector?
Well, I think what we saw last time was that most people now, or most upper middle class and sort of up, don't keep their money in banks. They put them in money market funds. And so you've got this rise of this, what has come to be known as the shadow banking system, because money market funds are not guaranteed by the FDIC. And famously, you know, after Lehman, there was a run on the money market funds. So how to deal with the growth both in the size of the financial system and its boundaries is a problem. What the Fed did in 2008 was guarantee all money market funds. Now that's a, you know, that's several trillion, and they don't want to keep that permanent. So they've relied in effect on regulation of money market funds, which then causes money market funds to pay very little interest, which is causing the money market fund business to disappear.
What you're describing is that fluctuations in a sense of trust have enormous consequences to the way the banking system is run, which accounts are used.
Completely. Banking is built essentially on not a lie, but I'm not even sure what the right word is. But a banker takes your money, says you can have it anytime you want, lends it to someone. And if we all went to the bank and tried to take our money out, the banker couldn't fulfill the promise. So the banker is relying on the assumption that we won't all rush to the bank and take our money out.
Thinking about trust, what do you think is the most astounding piece of trust between banks and consumers?
The current wave of mistrust is not a new story. I mean, we've had it four or five times in American history.
The hated bankers.
Yeah. I mean, we had it after the revolution when bankers made a ton of money by buying up government bonds from soldiers at 20 cents on the dollar and making a killing. We had it in the 1890s when J.P. Morgan had organized a sort of monopoly, the so-called money trust. We had it after the Great Depression, and we've had it now. So four times in American history. And it's taken some major changes to reinstate trust. And so the big question that I have post the financial crisis is that we did a whole lot through things like Dodd-Frank. But frankly, that doesn't seem to have worked. There is a sense that what you've ended up, though, is with a machine that's slightly out of control, and that the crises are going to become larger and larger. And I don't think anyone quite knows how to deal with that.
The 21st Century's Story. Liaquat Ahmed, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Liaquat Ahmed is the author of The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. To hear more from our trust series, head over to thetakeaway.org/trust. The series concludes tomorrow with a voice familiar to millions, and a topic close to all of our hearts.
I've recorded enough material that I could be gone and a robot could take over, you know, for the next 100 years. It'd be like that Tupac hologram.
That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. Trust me.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Another police shooting, this time in California. Alfred Olango, a black unarmed man, was holding a vape-smoking device when officers shot and killed him. His sister, who witnessed the shooting, had told police he was mentally ill. Besides stirring protests across the nation, this series of high-profile police shootings of African Americans over the past 2 years is starting to produce other kinds of changes. Starting this Saturday, for instance, North Carolina police will not have to release dash and body cam recordings under the state's open record laws. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory signed the law in July, saying, quote, "It sets up a legal process for the release of law enforcement video and takes the decision out of the hands of politicians and puts it in the hands of an independent court system." Requests to get pictures released in North Carolina would be severely limited to cases where the requester is in the footage or is an authorized figure, such as a family member or a district attorney. I'm joined now by Nancy Levine, who's director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you, John.
First of all, how widespread are these kinds of limitations on the release of video of body cam and dash cam images?
It spans the entire country because in all but the state of New Hampshire, the public records laws give a big loophole for law enforcement. So, and of course, video footage is considered public record in most states, although now we know not in North Carolina. But the law enforcement have the ability to withhold those public records if it's in an ongoing investigation or in the interest of public safety. And sometimes that language in the statutes is pretty broad and quite permissive.
Let's just distinguish between the release of the images to the public and the suppression of evidence in a court prosecution of individuals. Can you lay out that distinction?
Sure. There are some legitimate reasons why law enforcement might want to withhold footage because it is evidence. And there's some research to suggest that once a suspect or person in a case is able to see the footage, they change their stories, even if not deliberately, that, viewing the footage makes them, think about what transpired in a different manner. But that needs to be balanced against just the interest of transparency that body-worn cameras were supposed to provide. I mean, most people believe that the reason why agencies are adopting this technology, and quite rapidly, I would say, is to increase both transparency and accountability. And yet, when you have a new law that says that footage is not public record and can only be released to someone who's in the footage or their designee, a family member or an attorney, you're actually precluding law enforcement agencies from being as transparent as they may want to be.
Let's look at the language of Governor McCrory here. He says this legal process takes the decision out of the hands of politicians, the decision to release video, and puts it in the hands of an independent court system. Is there anything that concerns you particularly about the idea that the politicians versus the court system is how he's setting this up?
Yeah, I do take issue with that. On the one hand, I think that North Carolina did something really good that not many other states have done, and that is to be very clear about how someone who's captured in video footage is able to make a request to gain access to that footage. That's not very well spelled out in most states at this juncture. So that's on the good side. On the bad side of it, though, is these so-called politicians also include police executives who are trying to build sometimes from the ground up trust with the community. And if they're prevented from releasing footage in high-profile cases, the public is going to interpret that in the way you or I would, which is, what are they hiding? Why aren't they releasing it? Why aren't they being transparent?
Do you see these laws as an attempt by law enforcement lobbyists to get a special provision for uniformed police officers?
Well, I don't know the details behind the law in North Carolina and how it was introduced and passed, but I will say that there's some good reasons why these types of laws are being passed in general, and allow me to explain. Public record is one thing, but it's another thing to deliver any kind of footage based on any kind of sweeping request. So what I mean by that is, oftentimes the media will request footage for, the last 6 months, and they want to see everything, and it becomes a bit of a fishing expedition. Now, I'm sure as someone in the media yourself, you might think, okay, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is that law enforcement agencies don't have the resources or ability to redact the footage to make sure that they're protecting the privacy and identity of the people who are captured on it.
Nancy Levine is director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
So what's it really all about, that awkward discussion in the Clinton-Trump debate about a beauty pageant winner who gained weight and had to endure being called Miss Piggy by Donald Trump? The exchange on Monday and the fallout all week long, where Donald Trump defended his statements as reasonable, and the analysis by pundits that this was a clever trap set by the Clinton campaign, misses a much larger point. We casually mentioned that it's felt like open season on the fraud-accused Wells Fargo Bank recently. Well, people who are overweight or obese would say it's always open season on them. Research shows strongly held stereotypes that people with obesity are considered to be lazy, unsuccessful, and unintelligent. That bias even continues in the healthcare industry, which makes billions of dollars trying to treat people with the condition of obesity. A study in Houston showed doctors viewed patients with obesity as more annoying and a bigger waste of time than patients without the condition. As a result, patients are often misdiagnosed, with health issues being wrongly attributed to their obesity. Patty Neath serves on the Obesity Action Coalition's Weight Bias Committee, and Dr. Catherine Saunders is an obesity expert at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian.
So I think there's a common misperception that obesity has to do with willpower, when in fact obesity is classified as a disease. So I think having that understanding when treating patients with obesity is extremely important.
So what do you do to educate doctors? I mean, how did doctors approach this medical condition? I mean, did they just learn about the biology of obesity and bring their biases straight into the examination room?
That's a wonderful question, and that's something that at our center, the Comprehensive Weight Control Center at Weill Cornell Medicine, we are striving to work on. When I went to medical school, I really learned very little about obesity, but obesity medicine is one of the fastest growing specialties.
So, Patty, your experience with physicians really indicates directly how this can be painful and really affect the way in which healthcare professionals deal with you. What's your experience?
Bias in the medical community and in medical settings can occur in various ways. It can be very subtle, things like not having appropriate equipment, such as a large enough blood pressure cuff to get an accurate reading on a patient, or even the chairs in the waiting room. But it can also be very overt and direct. I saw an orthopedist because I was having severe hip pain, and x-rays of my hips had not disclosed an obvious answer. He walked into the room, and I started telling him my symptoms, and he said, "Let me cut to the chase. You need to lose weight." Well, at that point in time, I had the very good fortune of working with a wonderful obesity medical specialist, and I had lost about 70 pounds. And I said to the orthopedist, "I'm surprised this is happening now because I have lost about 70 pounds. And his response, without batting an eye, was, "You need to lose more weight. Have you considered weight loss surgery?" By the end of his rant, I was in tears because I was humiliated and ashamed. And he said, "Look, you're even crying because of the pain and because of your weight." That's not why I was crying. I was crying because of the way he had treated me. And I lived through the pain for several more months and finally found another orthopedist who correctly diagnosed me as having severe progressive scoliosis in my back. I have a 60-degree curve in my spine. And that was what was actually causing my hip pain.
Does this raise the issue, Dr. Saunders, that doctors have a difficult time separating behavioral issues from medical issues, say, for example, with addiction? It would be difficult to treat someone with addiction if they come in and you go, "Well, why don't you stop using heroin, you big dummy?" I mean, that's just not going to be helpful.
Yes, I think that's a big part of the problem. I think also a lot of doctors just jump to the assertion that patients need to lose weight without even asking, especially in Patty's condition. Her story really exemplifies this, what a patient has already done. It's very easy to just look at somebody and say, "Oh, your obesity is causing this and you need to lose weight," without really delving into what's going on.
And that's really what this is all about, Patty, empathy. When Donald Trump uses that behavior in talking about a beauty pageant winner, Ms. Machado, he's basically using language that is tolerated in America for people
right.
with obesity. But he's not showing any empathy, and that's really the problem.
Right, and that's a big problem. And, you know, weight bias in our society is ubiquitous. You can't watch a sitcom without seeing it. And I think it's so ingrained that people don't even recognize it when it's smacking them in the face. When you're told your entire life by the medical community, by the media, that you're not good enough or it's all your fault, that you've made a choice to have obesity, you know, you start taking that on board. And we need to stop because it's just not true. We've had decades of advice to exercise more and eat less, and look where we're at.
Dr. Saunders, this whole issue with Donald Trump has been about an individual who doesn't seem to be in control of his biases regarding Arabs, regarding immigrants, and now regarding obesity. They're all part of the same thing here, it seems. And how difficult is this to get changed, whether we're talking about doctors or just society in general?
That's a great question. I think that what's required is quite a bit more education. So educating doctors on understanding that obesity is, in fact, a disease and that it is very complicated. And as Patty said, the answer is not eat less and exercise more. If that were the answer, we wouldn't be in the middle of an obesity epidemic. And also educating patients, I think, is very important for patients to understand that it's not right for them to be discriminated against and they deserve better care.
Dr. Catherine Saunders is an obesity expert at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Patty Neese is an attorney and serves on the Obesity Action Coalition's Weight Bias Committee. Thanks so much, Patty.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
And Lumosity, brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists working with university researchers to explore new areas in human cognition. Learn more at lumosity.com.
In the 13th year of the New York Arab American Comedy Festival, it hasn't exactly been a time of chuckles for Muslim Americans.
Donald Trump, have you even read the United States Constitution?
Aggrieved Father Khazer Khan shouting angrily at Donald Trump at the Democratic National Convention this summer. But all that emotion has been a blessing in disguise for the festival, which kicks off today at comedy clubs throughout New York. The theme this year is, gotta love this, Make America Laugh Again. And the festival logo features a camel named Jamal D. Hump, rhymes with, that's right, a dead ringer for a certain presidential nominee.
For those of you who don't know, I went to Gaza to catch my husband. I went to Gaza because they have no place to run. It's like shame. And we've been married 4 years, and it's amazing. See, you're all in shock. Why? Because everyone thought he would run once he got the 10-year green card. And he's still here.
That's festival co-founder Mezun Zayed performing at the 2014 festival. Her co-founder, Dean Obidallah, is back with us in the studio. He's a former attorney turned comedian and host to his own show on Sirius XM Radio. He says he may even have said a prayer or two this year for the bumper crop of laughs from this year's election campaign.
I think we're in a fearful mood. I think the community is palpably scared. But I think sometimes laughing at the boogeymans that scare you is good for anyone, regardless who it is. And I think maybe it helps heal. So I think comedy is a way to cope with a stress that our community is going through right now. And it's a challenging time, but I think perfect time to laugh. And this year, it'll be a lot of political humor.
Now, when you say political humor, is it all about, you know, Khazer Khan and Trump? And I mean, that was about the most unfunny moment
right
in the entire campaign. But I'm sure you'll find something to do with it.
Trump jokes will be an avalanche of Trump jokes. You're going to see so many from obvious things, maybe some jokes about his hair, to more substantive things like the Muslim ban, which I joke about, and the idea that they ask them, how will you know if someone's Muslim? He said, well, we'll just ask them. That seems pretty foolproof at customs. They ask some guy, what's your religion? Me, my friend, I am an Episcopalian. Okay, you're in. I mean, even his proposals that get the support of his fan base, and they are a fan base to me, they're not just voters, it's a fan base, make no practical sense whatsoever, but it doesn't matter. So we try to cut through that. We try to have some fun with it. Don't be afraid of them. Let's laugh at them, but let's register and vote and get out on election day or early voting and get out and vote.
Don't be afraid of him. He's carrying you.
He has said stuff in this campaign, especially about Muslims. And again, people interchange Muslim and Arab all the time, and we don't, yeah. But the reality is most people do. You know, when he says things like Muslims cheered on 9/11 in New Jersey, that's not a policy proposal. First, it's a lie, but second, it gins up hate of our community,
right, no, yeah.
Or Islam hates us. With a statement like that, which is off the charts in today's world to say something. And sadly, and the unfunny part is we've seen hate crimes. I mean, in New York just 2 weeks ago, we had a hate crime against two Muslim women with hijabs pushing their baby carriage. A woman ran up to them, started screaming, punching them, get out of my country, cursing at them. It's not a coincidence that woman on social media is a self-professed Trump supporter. Trump is not making them hate Muslims or Arabs. He's emboldening them and making them feel comfortable with his hate. And that's what's really alarming, I think, to our community. So many communities of color. I've seen more anti-Semitism online now than I've ever seen in my adult life. Because as Muslims, we're powerless, frankly. We don't control the media yet. That's going to come one day, John. But one day we will. But we have no control.
Who controls the media again?
I have no idea.
Let's not get into that.
Right. But but according to David Duke, and literally in the articles he's written, he says the Jews have, and they're trying to stop Trump. So that animates these white supremacists to go after Jews in the most vile terms I've ever seen. So it doesn't matter what your background is. Honestly, if you need a laugh, and I'm not just plugging it because I produced the festival. I'm sincerely saying if you need a laugh at Donald Trump's expense, this is the time to do it. Come out to the festival in New York and have some laughs together.
America has trouble sometimes with the categories of humor. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, Jon Stewart makes jokes about Jews in the media all the time. But do you feel like you can't do that?
No, I don't think, first of all, it wouldn't be accurate. He's doing it to make fun of it. It's ironic,
yeah.
In a way, satirical. I don't think Jews control the media. I don't think anyone, I think big business and money controls the media. That's reality. We all know that. Most of our jokes are about us. So certainly there's that inside Arab stuff. And I do jokes about going to the Middle East and performing there. And even if you've never been to the Middle East, I think you'd get it. Arabs love to talk in the movie theaters. Like, it's insane.
It's
insane. So loud. Yeah. In the Middle East, it's like a business meeting going on. People playing charades. There's a picnic going on. And Arabs love to explain to you what you're watching on the screen. I was sitting with my friend, and a guy gets shot on the screen. My friend goes, look at that. They shot him. I'm like, I'm right here. I'm watching the same film you are. But Arabs in the Middle East, not here in America, do this. So Arabs, that kind of jokes resonates. But I think others get it from the context. It's still funny.
So Mission Impossible, oh, that's Dubai. There's going to be a sandstorm.
Right,
in a minute.
Sandstorm. Look, they're kissing. Don't look, it's haram, but still, they're kissing. So you have a lot of Arab culture. And again, we have Arab Jewish comics, Arab Christian comics, Arab Buddhist comics.
Okay, so is there a joke that begins, an Arab Christian, an Arab Jew, an Arab Muslim go into a bar?
Not yet, but there's going to be. I like that very much. I like that idea of bringing us all together. I like the fact that we have these different faiths and comedians talk about it from their point of view, being Arab and Jewish. My friend Noel El Grabli, who's in the festival, is coming from L.A., who's Jewish. We have other Jewish comics, too. But he talks about being Jewish and Arab and getting anti-Arab stuff and anti-Semitism. He's got to deal with both now, and his challenges are a little bit more. And his first name is Noel, which is like Christmas. But I think it's interesting that you hear from Arab Christians talk about being accused of being Muslims. And on some level, them even defending Muslims because we're in this community together. And thankfully in America, while some might want to divide us by faith, most of us reject that. So to say the community feels under siege would be an understatement. That's not hyperbolic. The community truly feels under siege right now.
But does the comedy community want Trump to win?
No. Deep down, I know what you're getting at, John.
Yeah.
He, Donald Trump, good for comedy? Yes. Les Moonves said he's good for CBS. This man is not the normal thing. This is not George W. Bush, where I didn't want him, but he helped my comedy career, objectively speaking, and we could laugh at him because he was a threat on some level, but it was not this direct personal threat. Donald Trump is not political to us. To our community, it's so personal. I don't care if it helps comedy or not. I'll deal with Hillary Clinton as president the same way we dealt with Barack Obama, who was a challenge for comedian 8 years later. There's not been a ton of Barack Obama jokes in these 8 years. I think there was more in 1 year of Bush than 8 years of Obama. Because it was easier to make
one week of Trump.
In a day.
This is the New York Arab Comedy Festival, which kicks off today at comedy clubs throughout New York. And is there streaming where you can get YouTube?
Not yet,
and
unless
stuff,
but, you know, the FBI probably record the show. So well, you can do a Freedom of Information Act request afterwards and get a copy of our videos, which I've actually tried to do.
Have Snowden email it to you. Yeah.
I've literally tried. I've made requests to the FBI and NSA to see if they had videos of our old shows. And I got that boilerplate language. We can neither confirm nor deny. There's no doubt, because we started this festival 2003. It's our 13th year. There's no doubt in the first few years after 9/11, hundreds of Arabs uniting in New York. There was NYPD undercover. There's probably FBI undercover. They probably have videotape. Now, I'm not sure.
The NSA commemorative box set.
That'd be great.
The Arab Comedy Festival.
On eBay.
I love that. Yeah, on eBay. Dito Adala is festival co-founder and co-executive producer of the SiriusXM radio show. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me, John.
I'm Zach Rouse in Eureka, California. The most obvious, funniest moment in this election cycle was by far when the sweet little birdie landed on my man Bernie's podium, and he had to pause to recognize that he was being recognized by nature as the only legitimate candidate in the running.
This is David in North Miami Beach, Florida. My favorite part of the election so far is Trump's sniffle. And Hillary dancing with her shoulders like Shaquille O'Neal.
Middletown, Connecticut chooses the Hillary shimmy. What's not to love? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number where you can send your assessment of the funniest moment of the campaign. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.